Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
At Great Wolf Lodge, there's adventure for the whole family. You and your pack can splash away in the indoor water park where it's always 84 degrees. There's a massive wave pool, a lazy river, and tons of water slides for your pack to enjoy together. And the fun doesn't stop there. Get ready to explore and play at adventure-packed attractions from Magi Quest, a live-action game that takes place throughout the lodge to the Northern Lights Arcade. There's also a bunch of great dining options and complimentary daily events like nightly dance parties, all under one roof. And the best part? With 22 lodges across the country, you're always only a short drive away from adventure. So bring your pack together at a lodge near you. Book your stay today at greatwolf.com and strengthen the pack.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. This is Sam Dalton. I am kind of in awe today as someone who is a political junkie. I am joined by the incredible Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action, who has had an incredible, overwhelmingly impactful career over the last 13 years. And I feel very, very lucky and very, very starstruck to be chatting with her today. So Shannon, thank you for coming to chat with us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
With that said, I would love for anybody that maybe isn't familiar with you and the work that you've done, I would love for you to give us like a little run through of your life since Sandy Hook and everything that kind of happened with that and how you got where you are today. I would love to hear that story from you.
Yeah, when the Sandy Hook school shooting happened, it was 2012, and I had been taking about a 5-year break in my career in corporate communications. I had remarried and my husband and I were blending our family of 5 kids. At the time we lived in suburban Indianapolis, and it was just like a very cold day. And I remember folding, you know, these huge baskets of laundry, and I had the TV on in the background, and suddenly there was a chyron that said there was breaking news. There was an active shooter inside a school in Newtown, Connecticut. I'd never heard of this place before. And I just sort of, like so many other people who are listening, I'm sure, stopped what I was doing, sat down on the edge of my bed and just watched this horrific tragedy unfold. Right before the holiday season, 20 children, 6 educators slaughtered in the sanctity of an American elementary school by a teenager with a semi-automatic rifle. And I went to bed in tears, just sobbing, devastated. My husband was trying to console me, and I woke up the next morning, and at some point in the night, that sadness had turned to just abject rage.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't really know what to do with myself, but I knew how to create a Facebook page because I had done it recently for something else. I only had 75 Facebook friends at the time. I was not exactly a social media phenomenon, and I wasn't even on Twitter. And so I thought, okay, what I can do is just create this page and try to have a conversation with other women about the need for something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving for gun safety. I had Googled, how do I join an organization? And it came up with like think tanks, everything run by men, some one-off city and state organizations, nothing combined and also run by men. It felt like doing something, creating this page. It was one of the first things that went viral on Facebook, where my 75 Facebook friends, also women who were grieving what had happened, shared it with their friends and on and on and on. And within a week, I was on the cover of USA Today.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it was the right idea at the right time.
Yeah. Well, oh my God. I have so many questions. My brain. What was that type of transition like for you to go from I'm just a, you know, and I say this with all the respect in the world, an invisible person, right?
Yes.
A day-to-day average normal lady. Average person that nobody knows to this like national, international stage at that point. What was that like for you?
You know, they always say there's like a fine line between naivete and stupidity. Thank God I was like straddling that line because I had no idea what was coming for me. None. I know it sounds naive, right? It is. But I was a stay-at-home suburban mom and I was very focused on raising my kids. And yes, I knew that gun safety was like in the zeitgeist somewhere, but I didn't realize how polarized it was. And I didn't realize that there would be people that would immediately threaten my life, the lives of my children and my family, you know, threatened sexual assault against me and my daughters, that people would text me and call me and email me and DM me and actually drive by my home. Like, I'm glad I didn't know those things because, you know, that came later and I had to, you know, sort of figure out, okay, am I going to double down or back down? Lots of times. But that's sort of the public-facing part around the threats and the extremism that I had to deal with. But it was also a huge shift in my personal life because, as I said, I had only been remarried for a couple of years. And I had all these kids aged, like, I think they were 12 to 19 at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, that's like in the thick of parenting. And I was busy with driving and cooking and doing all the things that you do when you have five kids. And it was a huge adjustment to that, right? Like I suddenly became busier than I had ever been in my paid career. I was flying all over the country. It was like a startup. And so thankfully when my husband and I married one another, we'd both been married previously, we decided we would go to therapy at least twice a month, no matter what. And I do feel like that really got us through that huge upheaval and transition.
When you realized what this was about to become, even if you didn't know exactly what it was, but you saw that this was something monumental, earth-shattering in some circles. I mean, I remember way back when seeing you on TV. I remember reading about what you were doing. I remember like just Moms Demand Action became this normal part of the conversation around gun safety and gun policy and gun regulation. Like through that process, as this thing became what it became, how did you deal and cope with it? Well or not well? Or like what was that part of your experience like?
What helped me? I mean, a lot of people and a lot of volunteers said this, you know, like I remember one volunteer came to me and said, I am not Malala. Like, I am not going to be the tip of the spear on this.
No.
You know, I am not going to use my last name in public. I am not going to put my family in danger. And I respect that. And I completely understand it, especially women who are in red states.
Right.
I did not have that choice because I was the ultimate tip of the spear. I was the spokesperson and the front forward face for the organization. And so, you know, I can remember one time when there was this pickup truck that was driving by my house and I had gotten sort of the Son of Sam letter in my mailbox, you know, where I cut out of magazine letters and all of it. So I thought, okay, I know what I'll do. I'll do what I've done in the past when there's been a problem, which is I'll call the local police department and they'll send out an officer and I'll just say, keep your eye on the house neighborhood. Officer comes out, I explain what's happening and he looks at me and says, well, ma'am, that's what you get when you mess with the Second Amendment. Right? An officer.
What?
You know, I have spent my whole life being taught, like, these are people who will protect you no matter what. Like, they're not partisan. They're not political. And I really think in that moment, I was like, okay, as I said before, I'm going to have to back down or double down. I have a choice to make, and I have to kind of stick with what I decide. And I will be honest and say my kids and my husband were very supportive. Like, they were not saying, don't do this, Mom. We're really worried. They kind of thought it was badass.
Well, because it is.
And I think that helped me, you know, to not be scared.
Yeah.
But also, my husband often says, I have the personality that of a gremlin. Like, if you feed me after midnight, I'm going to lose my mind. And I think that's how, like, if people try to intimidate me, that's how I am, like a gremlin. I do not like when people try to silence or intimidate me. And I would say the other piece of it is you're working with all these other survivors. At that point, you know, I had early on met the family members of who had survived the Sandy Hook school shooting and other gun violence survivors. And when you meet those people, you realize, like, if I lose my kids, I have nothing left to lose. So what would be the point of allowing myself to be intimidated or silenced? So I think it was all of those things that kept me going. That is not to say, you know, I talk a lot about how I had a lot of mini breakdowns crying in my closet because I was so overwhelmed. It was so much like a startup. I was doing this with total strangers. I felt so much pressure to make sure this organization lasted. Like, when you're just starting, you're always kind of on the bubble. It could go either way.
Right.
And little did I know, you know, that feeling of being a startup was going to last for a lot of years. Yeah. But you get used to it. You know, it sort of like things started to click into place and I started to have support systems that helped me make it go. But in those early months, it was exhilarating, but also exhausting and a little scary.
Truly, it's remarkable. I mean, that's just the word that keeps coming to my mind. But what was the moment for you, like, when it was starting out in those first, like, maybe a couple months or years where you had a moment where you realized maybe what this thing was becoming?
Well, the very first night I started the Facebook page, my husband and I went to bed and he said, "This is going to be a very big deal." And he did not say that in a happy way. So I think it felt a little bit like lightning in a bottle right from the beginning, because so many women were calling and DMing me, you know, like, I had all these threats on one side, but on the other side, the fact that I was, my phone number, my email address, all those things were publicly available was helpful, because all of these women who were perfect strangers from across the country, whether it was Silicon Valley or Houston, Texas or Washington, D.C., they were reaching out to me and saying, "Oh, you are doing this. This was an idea we had, or this was something I wanted to do, or I looked to join something like this, like I had." Mm-hmm. Many of them, you know, Gen X women. And I that was the secret sauce. I mean, that support system of these other women who said, I mean, women who walked out of their jobs the day of the Sandy Hook school shooting and said, "I'm never going back. I'm never going back, because this is so devastating and so life-changing that I have to go volunteer." And I had this army of women, again, women I didn't know, who were just jumping in and working as hard as I was to get this thing off the ground.
I truly think, and I know everybody says, like, a version of this, and sometimes it's joking. Even as a therapist, I'll put my therapist authority hat on. I truly think if women were in charge of everything, we'd have everything fixed in 6 months.
1,000%.
And that's even being generous. That's like giving us time.
Yes. I completely agree. There is nothing more formidable and terrifying than a whole bunch of type A women.
No. Oh, God, no. No. That problem is actually already solved. Whatever problem you've put in front of them, it's actually already solved. You just have to let us solve it.
Let them cook.
Let them cook. Let them do it. What for you over the years as you were leading Moms Demand Action, how and the wins and the disappointments and the ground gained and the failures and all of that, what was it like for you keeping the faith through that and that resilience? Like, how did you do that? And I know that that's such, like, a broad, big question, but
I have a theory. You're the therapist. I'm not. But my theory is that everyone has a go-to emotion.
Yeah.
When things get difficult. Like, my husband says his go-to emotion is loneliness. Like, I'm alone. There's no one here to help me. Mine is anger. Sadly, there are enough shooting tragedies in this country to keep me angry during those 11 years that I did this work. And I really find that I can quickly turn anger into righteous fuel, and it activates me to keep going. I also have severe ADHD, untreated my whole life.
Yeah.
and I mean, like, you know, people often say to me, "Oh, you're so lucky. You know, you must be a natural born leader. That's how you did this." No, I am an introvert. I am an only child. I am incredibly shy. I had a debilitating fear of public speaking. I barely made it through middle school, college, high school and college, due to ADHD. Like, I'm not the person people would point at and say, "Oh, that woman over there, she should take on the most powerful, wealthy special interest who's ever existed." But it turns out a lot of those things were actually what made me so good at the job. You know, I could wake up and go down a rabbit hole for 11 hours on an issue that's never impacted me.
Right.
And do that every day for 7 days a week, unpaid, because I was so passionate about it. And I do think that my ADHD was, you know, the anger combined with ADHD was sort of what kept me burning for so many years.
Yeah. But I mean, again, you don't even need a team at that point that you could.
Exactly. I am a team. Yes.
You are the team.
Yes.
Wow. That is because I think the reason I'm kind of going with this train of thought is because I think this moment that we find ourselves in now, which we can pick apart for there are entire podcasts dedicated to picking it apart. But I think the pervasive feeling that I've experienced on a personal level that I hear from other people that I know both personally and professionally is a sense of hopelessness. And understandably so, given certain moments and certain scenarios that we find ourselves in. And when I look at your story and what you've done, I think it is such an incredible testament to maintaining hope in the face of uncertainty. And I think, is that something that you relate to in your journey? That concept of like having to dig deep to find that sense of like purpose when it's not working.
This won't surprise you here, but when people aren't hopeful, it makes me angry. I think I understand it on one hand because things seem overwhelming. And so I understand if people feel hopeless or helpless. What I don't understand is when people stay stuck there. Because I think what I have seen in my activism is that cynicism is often an excuse for inaction. It's so much easier to say, it's too big, it's too hard, I can't do anything, I'm too small. That, you know, that is like sort of being willfully obtuse. And that does make me angry because if everyone is hopeless and helpless, then nothing gets done. And when we live in a democracy, which, you know, we kind of still do, I guess, then, you know, it is sort of on all of us to each take a piece of the work and to do that work. And I also think about the North Star of the movement, which are gun violence survivors. They don't have the option to feel hopeless or helpless. So many people, whether it does, you don't have to be talking about gun violence, right? Any issue, there are always people who are marginalized and they do not have the luxury of acting as though this is not a problem. And I always, you know, there's the quote by Alice Walker, which is, activism is the rent I pay to live on the planet. Oof. I think we should all be thinking of it that way, like Tikkun Olam. Like there's all these religions that have a sentiment that is similar to that. And maybe it's not so overwhelming when you think about it. Like I don't have to take on all the work. I don't have to start an organization. You know, I don't have to take on gun extremists. I just have to figure out what my lane is. And I often talk about, you know, this is sort of the thesis of my book, but there is a formula for this. Figuring out what your values, abilities, and desires are. They're different for everyone. And practice mirroring those things over and over again. If you are very clear on your values, abilities, and desires, then you know exactly how you can help. You know, maybe you're a data entry specialist who values community and desires to help an organization that's working on a cause you care about, that you can then go in and organize their data. That sounds like a very small role or job. Data entry people are the unsung heroes of activism. That's such so hard, true. Important manual labor.
Yes.
So, you know, I do think we have to abide by Alice Walker's saying. And then I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, this is how I think of it as a mom. If my kids, when they were little, were sick and it was, you know, 3 a.m. and they're barfing and I'm exhausted and it's just like it's been going on for hours, I don't look at my kid and say, wow, you're really sick, but I'm really tired. I'm going to go to bed and I will catch you at 8 a.m. Hopefully you're doing a little bit better. We'll just check in then and see how things are going, right? You hold that kid's hand until they're better. No matter how tired you are, no matter how much you want to go to bed, no matter how long the night's been. And I think democracy is a sick child. Like we have to hold his hand until it's better.
I really cannot overstate how deeply I agree with you. Because I and I'm really glad to hear that I think we actually see this almost identically, because in my work as a therapist, I'll start with like the personal route first. Like midway through last year, it felt like from January to June, it was just like a constant daily onslaught of like someone taking a sledgehammer to like a Tiffany lamp, like all day, every day. And it was so overwhelming and it was so unprecedented in the scale and the speed. Not unprecedented in this is a country that has fallen woefully short of its mission since its founding. But I think it was the first time we had someone that was gleefully trying to rip it apart for their own gain. And what I realized was the approach that I was taking mentally wasn't working. The doom scrolling, the spiraling, the catastrophizing, right? Well, if this, then this, what if this, and what if that, right? And what I started to do was to get insanely hyper-specific on what I could do. And what I realized was, okay, I have a platform. I see one-on-one clients. I do coaching and consulting work, and I have a podcast. So how do I take care and regulate myself so that I can show up as a force for other people and that I can be a container for their stress and their uncertainty and hold their hand as like we guide this together?
Yep.
And I realized because of the amount of time that that took for me, my job wasn't to go out and also start a foundation, right? Like, and that was okay. I wasn't doing any less because I couldn't do this big, you know, attention-grabbing thing that could maybe have like some immediate impact. And over the course of the last, you know, 9-ish months since that time, the recognition of we are all the sum of our parts. And I think what I'm noticing is so many people are putting so many pressure on so much pressure on themselves that they have to care about everything at the same rate and pay attention to everything in the same way with the same level of depth and understanding. And they're spinning out because it's not humanly possible. And so to spend time focusing on what is one thing that you actually deeply care about? What is the one thing that directly impacts you or your family member or a friend? And how can you devote time to that? And I'm so glad you brought up the hopelessness, because I think as white women, our job is to realize that we have no room to feel hopeless.
Yeah. And also, white women make great activists. Yes. Because they believe the system works.
Yes. Yes.
So like, yes, you want a permit for your rally? White women get that permit for you in about 30 minutes because they know how to work the system and they believe it works for them. And I mean, like, there are important roles that women play. And I talk about this a lot. And I want to say, I did not come to this work as a fully formed white woman. I'm still not.
Right.
Like, I make mistakes and mess up all the time. And just to give you an example, when I started Moms to Men Action, we were very focused on school shootings and mass shootings, which affect about 1% of the population in this country, right? The daily gun violence that kills over 120 people is with handguns, most of it in city centers, most of it Black and brown people. And I did not, it took years for me to understand why gun violence needed to be looked at more holistically. And a lot of that was because of the mentorship of Black women, right? And so I don't pretend that I'm like holier than thou. All I'm saying is I think white women, and I do see movement on this since I started doing this in 2012, but I do think white women need to see that your whiteness will not, Brittany Packnett Cunningham says this, the activist, your whiteness will not protect you from what the patriarchy has in store for you.
No, no. I that is so profound, because I think really critical examples of that on the national stage are what has happened to the careers of Elise Stefanik, Nancy Mace, and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yes.
Right? Like, I think yes, those three women
they've
are the
all perfect been pushed out.
Yes. And they sold their career, yep, souls in order to try to get to the top, thinking that they would be rewarded for that.
Yep.
And they were punished.
Yep.
They were punished for it. And I think that is like the ultimate example of nobody wins in a system that's built as a pie. And that internalized misogyny tells us that, like, well, no, I have to operate within this as a pie. It's limited. It's scarce. There's only so much for them and so much for me. And I now have to be just like the people at the top in order to, like, claim what crumbs are left for me.
Exactly.
And they'll take the crumbs.
Yep.
Because they don't care. So I think learning that at first, and I'm sure your entry into activism, you know, my background is I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So I, you know, in undergrad and graduate school, like, spent a lot of time, like, unpeeling this, and then in my professional work, kind of understanding, like, what is my role as a white woman in the system, right? Like, when is it my time to use my voice? When is it my time to be quiet? Like, how do I navigate that, right? And I think right now in these moments, I just realized me spinning out and being upset was detracting from the people who are actually being physically, yes, tangibly impacted by these policies.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's hard to sit with. It's hard to realize that we have emotion about it. It's horrible. It's devastating to see. But our emotion is not the prime element,
right,
of what's happening.
Yes.
And it's hard to sit with, I think.
But sitting with it is the beginning, right? And I was very heartened by the election results. Not that so many white women voted for Donald Trump, but that for the first time, Gen X white women outperformed for Harris than Biden by 5 points, right? So, like,
yeah,
I think we will get there. Maybe not, I hope, in my lifetime. But these conversations have to continue because it's so important that we are advocates and allies and thinking outside of our bubble.
So I work from home full time, and something that I am always on the hunt for are comfy clothes that I can wear while sitting all day in my house, but looking professional and put together. And I have found an answer, and I want to share this answer with you, which is the bamboo jogger set from Cozy Earth. Now these, you've heard me talk about Cozy Earth a million times and how comfortable their sheets and pajamas are. But when I tell you their clothing is made from the same exact material as the sheets and the pajamas, I'm being honest. It is made from the viscose from bamboo, which is what all of their products are made from. And these are the softest, most comfortable joggers and jogger top that I've ever worn in my life, honestly. They are the perfect answer to when I just need to throw something on, getting started for the workday, feeling put together while also feeling comfortable. And because they're so lightweight and breathable, I find in this transitional time of year that we're in terms of seasons, it's like the perfect balance. Like, it helps you stay warm when it's a little chilly outside, but it's also really cool when it warms up as the day goes on. So the incredible thing about Cozy Earth that I always remind people is that there's two things. One, you get a 100-night trial with any product that you buy. Any product that you buy, you get 100 nights to return it if you're not happy with it. And then the second thing is, any product that you get also has a 10-year warranty. So if anything goes wrong, anything happens to it, you can let them know, and there is a 10-year warranty on that product. So I would love to give you a gift, okay, for the month of May. If you go to CozyEarth.com and you check out and you use code NUANCE, N-U-A-N-C-E, at checkout, you will get 20% off your entire order, okay? Go to CozyEarth.com, use code NUANCE, N-U-A-N-C-E, for 20% off your entire order. Can't wait to hear what you think. I know you have an incredible book called Fired Up, and I'm curious, like, when Moms Demand Action ended for you, what was that transition like? What, and again, no,
I could have used you as a therapist at the time.
I would imagine. Yeah. What? How did that pan out? Yeah.
When I started Moms Demand Action, I was on this conference call with a bunch of women, one of whom lived in Silicon Valley. You know, she was in tech, and we were getting off the phone, and she said, "Whatever you do, don't get founder syndrome." And I said, "Of course not." And then I hung up the phone. I had to Google, "What is founder syndrome?" And it's this idea that And I think it's so profound because it can apply to anything. It can be a job, it can be raising children, whatever, right? But the idea of founder syndrome is that when you found something, often your ego can become so enmeshed that when you leave, and everything ends in life, right? So when you leave, I also think about like my kids going away to college. When you leave it, you either want to burn it down because you don't want it to survive without you, or it can't survive without you.
Oof.
Right? So that's the idea of founder syndrome and ego enmeshment. And so I'm a practicing Buddhist, and I did not want to create a shrine to myself, this, you know, organization that glorified me. And so I said, all right, every year at the beginning of the year, I'm going to ask myself, is this the time I leave? Is this the time for me to go? Just reminding myself this was finite, that I didn't want, nor would it be good for the organization, for me to be its permanent leader until I died. And in those first few years, obviously, it was, no, it's not a good time. It was like a startup. In the middle, it was maybe, but then there would be a horrific shooting tragedy or a piece of legislation I needed to work on. And then I was standing in the Rose Garden in 2022. President Biden was signing the first federal gun safety legislation in a generation to pass Congress.
Yeah, I remember that.
We had the support of 15 Republican senators. I mean, this legislation had a snowball's chance in hell, and yet we just were relentless and got it over the finish line. And I just felt a knowing, like I heard a voice, or I felt, you know, I just, my intuition, whatever you want to call it, was telling me, this is the bookend to your activism.
Wow.
This is it. 11 years, you know, that was 10, give a year to say goodbye so that you can hand the baton over to somebody else and wrap up and move on. And that's what I did. I announced just a few months later to my team that 23 would be my last year, and I would spend the year saying goodbye and propping up the new person. And you know, it's sounds easier than it was. My whole identity had become wrapped up. You know, I can remember saying to my husband, like, when people say, okay, who are you? You know, nice to meet you. I'm Shannon Watts. Who am I if I'm not the leader of Moms of Inaction, right? And so, you know, thankfully I did get a therapist. I had my family to remind me why I decided to step back. And then I just started really focusing my time and attention on different things that excited me or lit me up. And one of those things was I got a call from Maria Shriver, who said, I'd love you to write a book for my imprint. So that certainly gave me, you know, a way to shift my focus. But it wasn't always easy. And when you like leave a job or leave anything, immediately the team starts to coalesce around themselves without you. And that can be a very strange feeling because you no longer have the power, the autonomy, and the, you know, the attention. And I also think sharing power is something we need to be more thoughtful about. I mean, I think Congress is a great example of this. These members of Congress never expected to live this long, right? Their parents' generation died usually in their 60s from smoking. Like, what do you do when you have power and the ability to continue holding it into perpetuity? I don't think the answer is that you cling to it. I think that the answer is that you share it and you pass it to other people. And women likewise don't have, you know, we're 25% of the 500,000 elected positions in the country. So we don't have a lot of great role models. And I think it's important to talk about power and what it means and how long we should have it and how we share it.
Wow. what I find really fascinating is I feel like you just, I think for me, just put into words a feeling I've been having around like this, the concept of transition. And I think something like even from a therapist lens, something that I've been talking about on my platforms is that we need people who are well. And the reason I start with that statement is because I think right now, so much of what I hear from people is, I don't know how to take care of myself while the world is burning down, or I feel selfish for living my life, or, you know, I feel so overwhelmed. I just don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. And the thing that I say is there will be an after to this. I don't know what that after looks like. I don't know how that pans out, but everything in history has had an after, no matter what the conflict, the problem, the issue was. And I think for you to talk about this idea of discussing power and how we transition out of power and how we like experience that ego death, we need people who are grounded and regulated and well in order to engage in that work and those conversations. And so I think there's this there's this fear that it's selfish to say, I need to be aware of myself. I need to be caring for myself. I need to be honoring my boundaries and my line, right? And constantly aware of, do I have enough energy to push or do I need to pull back?
And I also think having an identity that isn't one thing.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm sure you see this even with parenting, right? Like,
yep.
You can become so focused on one role that you have that it becomes almost impossible to let go of. And when we open the aperture and we're like, I'm not just the founder of Moms to Man Action, but I also love genealogy and I like to read and I go hiking and, you know, all these different things that we are that are important to us, we have to be sort of self-aware enough to do an audit occasionally and to say, have I put so many of my eggs in one basket that I'm causing harm?
Yes. Yes. To like myself.
Yeah. And other people.
I think so many people have a fear around expansion. Hmm. And I think that the recognition of their power and their influence. And I think, like, as I was listening to your story and kind of hearing blurbs of what all that experience was for you, I think what's so fascinating is like your refusal to back down from your power. Even when it was overwhelming and terrifying and you didn't know really what the next step was, but you stood in it long enough until that next step presented it to you. I just think that that is such a critical example right now to highlight of what we can each be doing right now in our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Of the recognition of like, I am so much more powerful as a person and an individual than I give myself credit for.
I meet so many women, and that's why I wrote Fired Up. I meet so many women who have brilliant ideas, and they may not be political. They can also be personal or professional. And they feel like they can't get started until they cross every T and dot every I. Like, God forbid they not be perfect or they fail in public, right? Like, so many women have been deterred from going after what they want because they feel like they have to be totally ready. If I had waited until I knew everything there was about gun violence, organizing, the legislative process, I still wouldn't have started Moms to Man Action. I was drinking from a fire hose for 10 years. And yet you look at the public and you see men, good and bad, everyone from Beto O'Rourke to Elon Musk, they fail all the time. And yet they continue to move up, right? They continue to have platforms. Women are expected to disappear. And we have to get over that conditioning that tells us we can't do something until we're totally ready or it's perfect or if it might cause us embarrassment or whatever it is. You know, I think that is what holds back women. And, you know, the number one deathbed regret in the world is that I didn't live a life that was true to me. And I think we're always waiting for people to invite us to do the thing. And nobody is going to invite you to do the thing. Activism, a promotion, getting a divorce. You're going to have to invite yourself to do the thing. And it isn't going to be perfect. And you're going to mess up a lot. But you're going to learn. You know, at Moms to Man Action, we had this slogan that was losing forward. Because when you take on the NRA, you know you're going to lose a lot. And I didn't want our volunteers to leave because they felt like they'd spent all this time and talent on something that didn't work. So we started to reframe losses as learnings so that they could win the next time. So maybe you lost a legislative battle, but you grew your chapter. You have new relationships with lawmakers. And slowly but surely, these volunteers saw, oh, they did win the next time. Right? If they kept at it, I think it's Babe Ruth who says you can't be the person who never gives up. Like, if you don't give up, you will eventually win. And I think that that is something that women have to undo the conditioning that tells them the opposite.
Oh, I could scream right now. I relate so hard. Because that is like my even, and you can tell me as someone that has occasionally consumed my content, that is the drive that I want to have in my content, is reminding women that it's hard because it is in fact hard.
Yes.
And something being difficult and challenging is not an indicator of your weakness or your lack of capacity or your lack of ability.
Yes.
It is simply because you are coming up against something that is, in fact, freaking hard.
Yep.
And I cannot agree with you more about, I think women have such an incredible opportunity right now to step up. And I know that sometimes women feel frustrated about that because it's like, well, it feels like we're always having to step up. And it's like, right, but that's what everybody has to do. That's what every human has to do to get a life that feels meaningful and purposeful.
Yes.
Is you have to be taking steps that feel really scary and really unknown. And in addition to everything you just stated, what I want to add as well is I think so many people think it's too late.
Oh, such a good point.
They think it is too late to change. They've gone too far. They cannot possibly course correct or turn this shipping tanker around. And it's like, well, you won't know unless you actually start to try to turn it around.
Okay, that makes me mad too. Because we are the wealthiest, healthiest generation that has ever existed.
Ever lived.
And, you know, my mom, born in 44, when I left for school, she was sort of expected to take up a hobby and disappear because she was no longer fertile and no longer relevant. We are so lucky to be living in a generation where when we turn 50, we're sort of just beginning a whole new chapter of our lives. A lot of us are, you know, either good in our careers or our kids are leaving for school or, you know, we can reassess who we are and what we want. If we want to go to medical school, we can. If we want to be a lawyer, we can. If we want to become an activist, we can. Like there's really not much holding us back except that fear that you're talking about, that fear of failure and not doing it perfectly. And legacy is such a loaded word. And I interviewed over 70 women for my book. And even women like Mika Brzezinski and Maria Shriver, when I said to them, what do you want your legacy to be? They were like, oh, that's too lofty of a word. Maria Shriver is a candidate.
Maria.
Yeah. And I just think we all need to be, you know, it's not your name on the side of a building. It's not a philanthropy named after you. A legacy just means you got to the end of your life and know that you lived it the way you wanted to and that you burned, right? Using the fire metaphor. And we should do that until it's over.
Drop the mic every other time. And I just have to sit here for a second and be like, she's so right. There's nothing left for me to say. That's it, everybody.
Legacy, but that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, like, no. Yes.
It could be that you are an excellent friend or an excellent partner. Yes. I mean, it doesn't have to be that you revolutionized the world.
Right. Right. I'm such a mega nerd, and I've been a history nerd for forever, my whole life. And something that I have found myself thinking of when I'm about to do something that feels like it's too big or it's too scary is I'll sometimes be like, what would a woman 100 years ago think if she knew that there was a woman standing here today about to do this thing?
Oh, I love that.
And having access to the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how dare I not take advantage of the work that she did back then, the bravery that she had back then to live her life, and I not take advantage of that today? And that's, it sounds so cliche and so cheesy, but that truly is something that motivates me and fires me up. And it's something that I try to impart on my clients as well, that like, these men are so gloriously mediocre on their best day. God. And they get to
I've met them, people. I have met them. These are not rocket scientists.
No, they just benefit from patriarchy if they get the benefit of the doubt no matter what they do. And they're told that everything that they do is amazing and great and wonderful. And women are told the exact opposite. And to recognize that that is not actually a feature of reality. It's just conditioning that can be undone.
I call this in my book, the double bind of fucksgiving, which is women are expected to give all the fucks about their family and community in the world. And then they also have to give zero fucks of what people think about them. You know, and I always say, I have no answer for this. I don't, because it's so incredibly complicated and it's like a koan inside of a riddle, right? Yeah. But at least if you know that you were expected to both be soft and hard in the world, you won't be surprised.
The approach that I often take, like with the women that I've helped and supported over my career, and I would love to know your thoughts on this, is I so harp on the importance of choice. And the understanding that it is okay to take a step back and realize that like a choice we made at that time even though it's not the choice we would make in this moment, that doesn't make that choice a bad choice. That was a choice that we made with the information we had at the time and what we were capable of taking on at the time. And to allow us as women to evolve. Mm. Like that we are allowed to evolve and change and pivot, and we can see things differently and we can want things differently. And something that's been fascinating for me in my work is seeing how many women are flipping on either they thought they wanted kids and now they realize they don't, or they thought they didn't want kids and now they do. And the guilt and the shame of like wrestling over that question. And I'm just like, it's okay. Like, you are allowed that freedom of exploration for your own life. You don't owe an explanation to anybody else.
I'm so glad you brought up guilt and shame. I have had so many women say to me, I wish I had a handbook that would help me navigate the blowback that I'm going to experience when I go out into the world. Because look, if you do things differently, that doesn't, maybe you're doing more, maybe you're doing less. But anytime you do things differently, people will have something to say about it. Yeah. And that will trigger those feelings of guilt and shame, whether it's your mother-in-law making a comment or someone in the kids' pickup line, doesn't matter. It will trigger in you guilt and shame as a woman.
Yes.
And then we do all of these different things to escape those feelings as opposed to just getting sort of comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. I truly believe your ability to grow your fire, right? The metaphor for going toward what calls you and away from what's limiting you is directly proportional to the amount of blowback you can withstand. And so if you make it a practice to be able to handle the blowback, and you know, I was able to interview people like Sharon Salzberg, who's a Buddhist meditation expert, and Dr. Kristen Neff, who's a self-compassion expert, like what it all comes down to is being comfortable with being uncomfortable. And how, you know, I was talking about how I had a debilitating fear of public speaking when I started Moms Do In Action. And it took probably 12 times for me to speak publicly until I stopped feeling like I might pass out or vomit or run away. Now I feel like I could speak extemporaneously to thousands of people without notes. The same can be said with handling blowback from other people and criticism.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And I think people are so intimidated by feelings because we provide absolutely no socialization of how to cope with them. And I think what's so difficult is everybody is biologically hardwired to experience the same seven emotions, but it's all learned in how you function through those. Mm. So we're all learning weird, different ways to do it, some that are great, some that are devastating. And then we all get mixed in together and we all try to learn from each other and we hurt each other. And it's just, it feels like it's just too big of a mess. And I think so many people feel that those feelings are really going to do them in if they allow them to live. That is, if they have to feel the fullness of whatever it is that they're running from, that will be their demise. And the thing that I always tell them is like, I have a metaphor that it's called the bear and the Yorkie. And a lot of times people will come to me and they are running full speed ahead. And right behind them, they tell me there's this grizzly bear. And it is like chomping at the bit to get them. But they've figured out if they stay like just fast enough out of reach, it's fine if it's there. It can be growling and screaming or whatever and snapping. But as long as they keep sprinting, they'll be fine. So they'll kind of come to me and be like, can you help me like run faster? Like how do I, what are the skills that I need to run faster? And what I like help them understand is like, well, my job is to like grab you by the shoulders and turn you around and realize that you haven't been running from a grizzly bear. You've been running from a Yorkie. And this Yorkie is your feelings that are cold and wet and hungry. And it's 4 pounds and it just wants to be picked up and held. And the second you do that, it might kind of wriggle and snap at you maybe a little bit because it's not used to that, even though it wants it. But when you start doing that, you actually allow yourself to learn how to cope and comfort and soothe. And the second you do that, you can do anything you want. Because it's exactly as you said, if you can figure out that being uncomfortable is not an automatic, like, you know, abandoned ship call. And to be able to learn the distinction between the two, the rest of your life opens up.
I interviewed a woman in the book who ran for, Asian American woman who ran for office twice. She desperately wanted to be the first Asian American woman elected to the state house in Texas. And she lost both times. She started as a Moms Demand Action volunteer, decided to run for office, didn't work out. And she said the amount of people who wanted her to disappear was unbelievable. Like, the women would say to her, oh, you know, you just need to not try again. People see you as a failure. And what she did, her name's Becca, she took all of that experience that she got from losing those two races, and she became the executive director of Emerge America in Texas, where she taught other women how to run for office. Like, wow. Everything that had happened to her prepared her to help all these other women win. Right? So it's like, I think if we can see the experiences we have, like, we're kind of going back to this idea of losing forward. If you put yourself out there, you're not always going to succeed. And you are going to be uncomfortable, and it's going to be a learning for you in the future.
One of my big questions that I wanted to ask for you, and maybe I think I might already know the answer to this, but I might not. For you in Moms Demand Action, what was like one of your proudest moments in that period of time?
Three quick things come to mind. The first is when we beat Starbucks. Volunteers told me we should not get involved in corporations and what's happening there. We should stick to legislative and electoral work. But women make about 85% of the spending decisions for their families. And we were so small, we could only do a mom cot of Starbucks, not a boycott. They were allowing open carry inside their stores.
Oh.
And within 3 months, we got them to change their policy. And that led to 500 other restaurants and retailers doing the same thing, which is huge. I would also say passing the federal gun safety legislation that I mentioned in 2022. But personally, we were talking about how overwhelmed I was in those early days. And my husband and ex-husband really had to step up. You know, we just lived down the street from my ex-husband. We shared custody. And one of the proudest moments I have is I had to travel a lot. And I had was on the, you know, just very busy. And I missed one of my kids won a soccer award. And there's still a picture that I have that I love of my husband and my ex-husband both, you know, on either arm of my kid, walking them across the soccer field. That's a moment that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't figured out how to find my fulfillment outside of only being a mom. And it also wouldn't have happened if they hadn't stepped up, right? And the other thing I will say is that when I interviewed these women for my book, I asked them all, what are you afraid your deathbed regret will be? And I thought they'd all say what we talked about before, that I didn't live a life that was true to me. No, not one of them did. Almost all were mothers, that they pursued what they wanted at the expense of their children, which is fascinating, right? It's guilt and shame again.
Yes.
Like even state lawmakers were telling me this. And I interviewed a therapist for my book who's a pediatric therapist. And she said, you know what kids need? They need their parents to have things that are important to them other than just their kids, because it's a lot of pressure. And they also need an example of how to pursue what it is you want. My youngest is 25 now. I can promise you none of them say to me, I can't believe you didn't go to that soccer game in 2006. I can't believe you didn't see the fifth showing of Cinderella in 2010. What they say is, I'm incredibly proud of you. And thank you for showing me how to do this in my own life.
I think that is so, so important. And I'm going to really care that even in my personal work as you know, being a millennial therapist, I am working with many, many first-time moms or, you know, having their second baby or their third baby. And I think to just emphasize wherever you are, whether you're child-free, whether you have kids, whatever your age, I think the synopsis that I'm hearing is like, we still get to do whatever the hell we want.
That is the perfect takeaway. Like,
we get to do whatever the hell we want and we don't.
That's a great summary.
Yeah, we don't have to be trapped by our own brain.
Yep. Or by the system.
No. And being told what we can and cannot do. Shannon, this was probably one of my favorite conversations that I've ever had. Yay! And I feel so lucky that I was able to chat with you and kind of get your take on everything that's going on. So thank you so, 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 so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Where can people find you?
I'm on most social media platforms at Shannon R. Watts. And then you can find me online at shannonwatts.org. And you can see events that are happening. We do a lot of community bringing together community in all different parts of the country, which I'm really excited about, where women are getting together in real life with the book. If there's anything we need in a post-polarized, post-pandemic world, I think it's knowing your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And yeah, those are kind of the main places, social media, my website.
Amazing.
Oh, Substack too.
Oh.
I have a Substack called Playing with Fire.
We love Substack. Thank you so, 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 so much. And maybe one day we can have you back.
Would love it.
Okay. Thanks.